The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Where do you draw limits on the issue of abortion?
Would you have any limits on abortion?
Does the president support abortion up until the moment of birth?
And what would your limits be on this? This limits, you know, nearly all abortions after 15 weeks. Where do you draw the line?
Should there be any limits on abortions?
Are there any limits on abortion you would find appropriate?
I don't believe so, no.
Women deserve access to abortion care. Abortion is health care.
My question was about any limits to abortion at any point.
The president has spoken about this many times, Peter, and I would refer you to his own comments about abortion. The president's view is that women should be able to make choices about their own health care. I'm not going to detail it further beyond what he said in the past from here.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, that was a montage of Democratic politicians refusing to name a single limit that they would see on abortion. And 80% of Americans support limits on abortions. We talked about this in the past, and I feel bad. I feel like I've been dealing with this issue a lot. But I do want to give you the inside story, the inside Catholic story of Dobbs, something that I don't think has really been told, and I want to give you a perspective on it. It is strange, though, how that particular party champions this culture of death. It's just not good for the country. It's not good policy. It's just bad all the way around. But it's part, I think, of a great deception that's going on. The case of Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization, that case, which of course brought about the fall of Roe, right? That's going to go down as one of the most controversial Supreme Court cases of all time. The Dobbs case is going to be one of the most controversial Supreme Court cases of all time. Of course, the Supreme Court, you know, could have avoided the controversy back in 1971 when it first accepted the case of Roe v. Wade by following the law, right? If they would have done that, if they would have ruled against Roe. Instead, what happened? The court majority, they found something in the penumbra and you know, the emanations of the Constitution that supported a right to privacy, and therefore, nothing can interfere with a decision between a man and between a woman and her doctor, you know, with this right to privacy. Over the years, legal scholars from all different schools of thought, liberal and conservative, really, they've criticized the decision. They've said it was bad law. That's why everybody knew that Roe was going to fall eventually, right? It was the right case that had to come before it. The court was criticized for legislating for the bench and something made up completely from whole cloth and having absolutely no basis in legal history or current law. But for the past, what, half a century, 50 years, it proved almost unassailable because the politics of the issue, it put just enough judges on the bench who support abortion to keep it in place. Even former Justice Ginsburg said it was bad law, right? And she said the same thing. But we see the influence of politics. We see these justices. When Planned Parenthood versus Casey came up, the court could have overturned it completely, but instead Justice Anthony Kennedy came up with his infamous definition of liberty. Remember this one? And I want to quote it. He says, quote, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." What? I could not believe that. Let me repeat it again. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. So finding the case to overturn Roe v. Wade was difficult, but surprisingly, it came out of Mississippi. And the state had passed a ban on abortions. It had that 15-week ban. You know, it had a ban on abortions after 15 weeks. And only, you know, the only abortion clinic in the state sued. And that was a mistake on their part, right? They ended up suing, and look what happened. The case ended up becoming Dobbs. And here's something else that was surprising that I found reflecting back on this. For a state considered, you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt, right? The primary author of the law is Catholic. How do you like that? Dr. James Taylor. He's the director of policy and legislative affairs at AFA Action, the public policy wing of the American Family Association. And besides the law that eventually became the Dobbs case, he's also the architect of Mississippi's Children's Promise Act and Pregnancy Resource Act. These are two very innovative tax credit programs that provide millions of dollars in funding for mothers. That's what we need to do, right? For disabled children, for children in foster care, for low-income families. So I am so grateful to have him join me today. And Doctor, thank you for your wonderful work. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on the show today, Drew.
I am delighted. You know, a lot of pro-life people think that a 15-week abortion ban isn't strong enough, that it should be a ban outright. Why did you settle, I'm curious, at that point in time for offering protection for the unborn?
Well, Mississippi had been very strategic in its approach to pro-life legislation prior to us working on the three-month ban on abortion. In 2014, we had passed a 20-week ban on abortion. That was not challenged in court. In 2016, we passed a dismemberment ban on abortion, which is a ban on a particular type of very gruesome abortion procedure. That also was not challenged in court. So our thought was, you know, what's the next step for Mississippi? Around 2017, I was praying about this. I was the president of a small nonprofit organization in Mississippi. Had a very small budget. We were struggling just to keep the doors open. But I felt prompted by the Holy Spirit to do something big. Some kind of big pro-life legislation was my sense. You know, legislatures have cycles.
Yep.
There's a year, for instance, to do education policy, healthcare policy. But I felt like this is the year to do something big for pro-life. President Trump had just been elected, but we had only had the balance of the court hadn't changed. Yeah. Justice Scalia had died and Justice Gorsuch had replaced him, but the balance of the court was the same. And I had a sense this is the time. And so I started talking to different attorneys around the country, the good folks at the Alliance Defending Freedom, consulted with their attorneys, also fellow Catholics. And we put together this idea of let's do 15 weeks. And my sense with that was 15 weeks is the international standard for limiting abortion. Countries like Russia limit abortion after about 12 weeks. Countries like France limit abortion after about 12 weeks. Can Mississippi at least get up to that international standard, that scientific and medical consensus that many countries around the world have agreed upon? My thought was, can we at least do that? And that would save about 200 lives in Mississippi, 200 babies in Mississippi that are aborted after that first trimester. And in doing that, we knew that we were pushing up against the Roe v. Wade and the Casey viability standard, which is basically this fake standard that the Supreme Court had come up with saying that states can't regulate abortion pre-viability. While we were making the case that, you know, state of Mississippi, we believe that for the sake of the health of women, for safety, for the protection of the life of the child, that we should have the right to regulate abortion even pre-viability. And so that was the thinking behind this legislation. And, you know, once we agreed upon the bill language, then I got to work building the coalition and getting the bill passed.
Well, I want to congratulate you on doing that. God clearly had a hand in this. It's phenomenal. Whoever imagined that this case would go all the way to the Supreme Court? Did you ever expect that? And then just in terms of the law, you know, so many other people have also just said it's bad law. It was badly written, you know, the Roe opinion. We knew it was a matter that it would matter of time before it fell. Did you ever think that this would go all the way up, that you'd be the kind of the tip of the spear or the dagger in the heart?
You know, I've worked on many pieces of legislation in Mississippi and in other states, and being conscious that they may get litigated. I mean, and sometimes, you know, I think the point is that you're willing to get litigated because you're doing the right thing. You're willing to get sued over doing the right thing. But I've never pushed legislation just to get sued. My approach to legislation and policy is always to do what is the right thing for this state? What is the next best thing for this state? And for the state of Mississippi, it made a lot of sense for us to be incremental and to be strategic in terms of banning abortion. Whereas, you know, we saw other states like Alabama in 2019, they passed a full abortion ban. That case is not the one that made it up to the Supreme Court. But, you know, again, we're talking about the Catholic story behind this case. There are a lot of Catholic elements, one of them being 6 of the 9 justices at this time are Catholic. I did a little bit of research on this. There have been about 115 Supreme Court justices in the history of the court. Only 15 of them have been Catholic. And what are the odds that six of those 15 are going to be on the court right now.
Wow.
And I know, you know, Justice Sotomayor, she obviously does not agree with us.
Right.
But still, you have to wonder, you know, there's kind of a Catholic imprint upon this opinion. And, you know, moreover, I'm Catholic, but I'm Catholic in a state like Mississippi, where Catholics represent 1-2% of the population. I work with a lot of folks on this legislation, especially the good folks at the United Pentecostal Church. We worked really hard together on this legislation to get this passed. Built coalitions and just, you know, crossed the aisles to get this done. But there is this Catholic element to it. Another thing I'll tell you, you know, I was reading a book by Mark Batterson, who's a Protestant author. He has a book called The Circle Maker. He talks about in this book literally circling places in prayer, you know, literally walking around them and praying around them. So during the debates on this bill, I would pray the rosary. I'd circle the Capitol, praying the rosary as the lawmakers were debating the bill, fasting, you know, for this bill. And I know a lot of people around the country have prayed and fasted for the end of Roe v. Wade. And we've seen other heroes around the country, you know, all those folks braving the cold every year at the March for Life, all those churches showing up, you know, making sacrifices to do that. It's this constant witness of the pro-life movement, I think, that made this possible. But, you know, there are some even other elements, other Catholic elements related to this. For instance, the bill was signed on March 19th, 2018. Well, that's the feast day of St. Joseph.
Yeah,
we know that the opinion came out on June 24th, the Feast of the Sacred Heart. You get this sense of God kind of exercising like his fatherly providence.
And the Feast of St. John the Baptist, and who lost his head speaking truth about marriage, you know? So it's amazing. I understand you also have the Sisters of Life involved through prayer.
The Sisters of Life are the unsung heroes of the Dobbs decision.
Wow.
And I'll tell you how all of this played out.
Yeah, please.
So I wasn't familiar with the Sisters of Life. They're based in New York. You know, I'm in Mississippi. I'm just doing my work. But I run across them, and I had made a small donation to their order. They called me up on this particular day. It was, I believe, in January of 2018. I had already started working on this piece of legislation. The bill was, you know, we were getting consensus on the bill. They called me up on this particular day and thanked me for the donation and asked, well, is there anything that we can pray for you? And I thought, yeah, I'm working on this pro-life bill. Can you pray that it passes? Well, that day, the bill passed out of its first committee in the Mississippi House of Representatives. So I knew right then after that happened that, wait a minute, there's something to these, to the prayers of these nuns. After the bill passed our Senate chamber and was on its way to the governor, I called up the Sisters of Life again, and I asked them, please pray for the governor to sign this bill, but also pray for the courts. Pray for the judges that are going to have to consider this legislation. So, you know, they prayed. We went to the federal district court where we lost. We went to the federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals where we lost. But then we saw some interesting things happen. Prior to this time, we had had a Democrat attorney general who had given the bill an okay defense. He's pro-life as far as things go. But obviously we had lost. In 2019, the first Republican since Reconstruction was elected to office as Attorney General in Mississippi, Lynn Fitch. Lynn Fitch saw this bill, and she saw that this was something special. She hired a great staff, and so they started to advocate, hey, Supreme Court, take up this bill, take up this bill. Well, the bill sat there, the case sat there, the Dobbs case sat there in front of the court I believe they met 18 times in conference. So month after month after month, they're meeting. They don't take up the case, but they don't reject it either. It's just sitting out there.
Wow.
And frankly, I had moved on. I moved on a little bit. In 2020, I worked on the Life Equality Act. I worked on that with a Catholic lawmaker, Carolyn Crawford. That legislation bans abortion when done for discriminatory intent. For instance, to abort a baby because of its race, because of its gender, because of genetic disability or whatever it may be. And I thought, well, maybe that's going to be the case that the court is going to take up. But I had a prompting, again, another prompting from the Holy Spirit. My thought was, hey, this was in April. And my thought was, I think I should call the nuns up again. So I called them up again, and I asked them, I remember this is April 17th, 2021. I called them up. I said, can you pray that the Supreme Court takes up the Dobbs case? And, you know, they kind of patted me on the head as far as you do that on the phone. And sure, son, we'll pray. We'll pray. 30 days later, wow, to the day, on May 17th, 2021, the Supreme Court announced that they were taking up the Dobbs case.
Wow. Amazing.
The first people I called, even before my wife, I called up the Sisters of Life, yeah, and I, you know, just like, your prayers worked, your prayers worked. And, you know, I was stunned and just, you know, grateful for God's providential work here. I don't think the sisters were surprised. I think they must hear this sort of thing all of the time, you know, getting their prayers answered. And then, of course, they prayed this case all the way through as the oral arguments were heard in December of 2021, and then as the case was decided in June. And I talked to them recently, and they said, you know, not only were we praying for this case, we were fasting for this
wow,
case. We added even a special fast on
wow,
Fridays specifically for this case. Now, you know, it sounds to me like the nuns are already pretty penitential.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure what a special fast for nuns looks like, but I think it must be pretty powerful.
I love it. I absolutely love your story. If you're just joining us, we're giving you a behind-the-scenes look at the inside Catholic story of the fall of Dobbs. And I believe all that you are saying here, Doctor, along with all the prayer and sacrifice of so many for the end of Roe, you know, finally reached its tipping point. And I'm so happy about that. Where are we right now? We know the battle continues, right? Will this be a major issue in the upcoming midterm elections? How do you think it plays out? And what do you see for the future of life in the country?
Well, you know, I think that the pro-life movement has to be more intentional. And I think that we have to hold Republicans in particular,
yep,
more accountable. I myself was looking at the 15-week law that we passed in Mississippi. We have an exception in there for fetal deformity. The language of that 15-week bill, I wouldn't necessarily support anymore. It's not strong enough anymore. So we can't settle for compromises, I think, especially exceptions for rape, for incest, for fetal deformity,
right,
health of the mother,
amen,
things like that. These compromises were invented by the left.
You're right.
In the late 1950s and popularized in the 1960s. States started to pass these exceptions to their pro-life laws, and these exceptions led to Roe v. Wade. We cannot allow these types of exceptions anymore. Now, if you have model legislation,
yep,
and you're, you know, strong model legislation without exceptions, push for that.
Yep.
If you have to make a compromise or a bill's going to die, you know, that is what
right,
it is.
Right,
and
right,
and in politics is all about compromise.
Yes, it is.
But I think we have to start with this idea that there should be no exceptions. And if you look at the state laws that Justice Alito cited in the Dobbs opinion, you see that there are no exceptions. The states did not have exceptions for rape and incest when they were banning abortion in the 1800s and in the early 1900s. No exceptions.
Yep, yep.
Because they recognize it doesn't matter whether you're conceived in rape or incest or whatnot. There shouldn't be an exception because abortion is wrong.
Amen.
So I think we have to have clarity for our message, and then we have to hold the lawmakers accountable.
Yeah.
At AFA, we have a website, iVoter Guide, where folks can go on and they can check out exactly what candidates believe. They can look up their views on life, on marriage,
yeah,
on other issues, and become informed voters. And when you're an informed voter, then you can hold politicians more accountable.
Great stuff. Hey, I want to thank you for your effort, for your witness, too, and for being a great Catholic. I'm delighted to have you here, Doctor. If people want to connect with
you,
what's the best way to do that?
Well, you can reach me at AFA. That's Jameson Taylor at AFA.net. I work on a variety of issues. You know, you mentioned the tax credit issue,
yeah,
that I've been working on, and that's maybe for another show about how that same year that we worked on the 15-week abortion ban, we also work to pass an innovative tax credit to help children in foster care, to help children that are being adopted, children and families that are in crisis. So, you know, the left always says, well, pro-lifers don't really care about kids once they're born. That's just absolutely false.
Yeah,
and we
right,
have the evidence to show that it's false. But folks can reach me at AFA, Jameson Taylor at AFA.net.
All right, Doctor, thank you. We will catch up again. That's Dr. Jameson Taylor, Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs at AFA. check him out. I do. Say a prayer for him, too. I think this whole concept of funding for mothers and aiding disabled children and working and, you know, for children in foster care is so critical. Hey, you know, he was talking also just about these candidates. I share his view where he says, we got to get away from this compromise, you know, where rape, incest, life of the mother, this whole type of a thing. There's a candidate that was running in Illinois. I saw some ads for him, and he stands for that. He's running on this no exception law. And they are pummeling the heck out of him in the media. Every time I see that guy on the air, I say a prayer for him. I just want to say to him, bravo. You stand for the principles, and we'll see what happens. You know, maybe God will raise you up and you'll be victorious. If not, you are a witness for truth, and we need you. Hey, when we come back, there is some unbelievable developments regarding COVID-19, the vaccine. I'm going to share some reports that were sent to me by one of our board members here. Sent me a couple of links. I did some looking into this. Is it true that there are metal-like objects found in 94% of the group that have taken the mRNA vaccine? What about the death toll following this? What about fertility for women who've had the vaccine? We'll look at that and we'll see whether or not we are now post-COVID. Are we out? This time last year, Omicron didn't really even hit. Are we in store for something that's even more evasive? Some scientists say yes. I'll bring you up to speed on that and more.
The Drew Mariani Show. Connected.
Connected.
Relevant Radio.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's good to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. It's been a while since we've talked COVID. And Joel, I want to thank you. One of our board members here sent me a link, and he suggested some great guests. In fact, Dr. Harvey Risch is going to be stopping by in just a moment. We're going to talk to him. He was one of the suggestions that he had sent over to me. And it was looking at where we are. And a couple questions here. Are we post-COVID? Is it behind us? Is it in the rearview mirror? Or are we going to see some new variant and manifestation of it in not too distant future? I was reading a report that future strains might be less of a concern, but they might be even more evasive. And how will COVID surge along with seasonal viruses, you know, the flu and others? There's a big push right now to get flu vaccines out there. Not everyone is doing that. But then there were some scary things that came up, and I always want to approach these with balance. I want to make sure that they're based in truth, and we'll try to get some perspective on it. Just share a couple headlines with you before we go to our guests. Check this headline out. It says, metal-like objects found in 94% of group who had symptoms after taking the mRNA vaccines. What? What is that all about? Well, I want to look at that. You know, they say that there's been autopsies done, and they found long strands in veins of people who were postmortem. There's a very famous doctor who has come out. He's a proponent. He was a professor of immunology, and he suspects that he ended up with cancer. He suspects that his third dose of the Pfizer-19 vaccine sent his cancer into overdrive. Could it be possible that these vaccines somehow are accelerating or impacting cancer in some way? I can't disclose this physician's name because you'll recognize it. He's a part of a group of about 24 other doctors. And he told me when COVID first took place, a lot of the doctors, 20 several, a number of them in his practice, all got the COVID vaccine shot. He didn't get it at the time. Six of the 20-something that got the vaccines came down with cancer. Now, an anomaly? Possibly. I don't know. He, from that moment on, refused to get the vaccine. There are other headlines like this. This one coming out of the UK. The UK government confirms 9 in every 10 COVID deaths over the last year have been among the fully and triply vaccinated. What's going on? And then finally, this doctor here who was a big promoter of messenger RNA, these COVID vaccines, he's now calling for a global pause. So I thought we'd take a look today at where we are. I don't know what you've experienced in your own life, whether there are concerns or not. The companies that made these vaccines are still coming out with boosters, are still pushing them, right? Are you getting boosted? I know our president got his shots, right? A lot of people are. And a lot of people think it's crazy to even talk about this. The government agencies want you to get them. But I'm getting the sense, and you can sound off here, but the vast majority of people, really, they got their first and second shot, and they don't want boosters. They're not going back for more. I know there's a push right now to go ahead and to get the boosters because two-thirds of the population has gotten vaccinations right now, and there are some problems with the narrative that the government is pushing. They're saying, they think the main reason is because, you know, people have gotten the vaccinations. They don't, you know, they don't think they need a third or a fourth. So there's been a push for that. The data from the UK, like I said, 90% of people have died from COVID-19. They were vaccinated. The medical journal Vaccine did a reanalysis of the data from clinical trials of Moderna and Pfizer. They found that Pfizer trial participants who received a vaccine were 36% more at risk of serious adverse events than those who received a placebo. Moderna's trial participants received the vaccine. They were 6% more at risk. And, you know, when we're talking about serious adverse effects, we're talking about death. We're talking about inpatient hospitalization, about persistent disability. So there been a number of reports from morticians, like I said, pulling out these very long stringy clots out of the veins of people who were vaccinated before they died. And they say they've never seen it before. And one of my producers actually followed up on this. He spoke to somebody about it. He said, no, that's the case. Other doctors are finding cases. You heard reports about myocarditis, right? Increasing dramatically in young men. Others say it causes cancer, right? Or it increases the cancer case or the chance of that. What's the truth? I don't know. I don't. I see a lot of these stories. I try to give you a clear and honest evaluation of this. That's why I've invited Dr. Harvey Risch to join me today. He's a professor emeritus of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine. And I am just delighted to have him with me today. Doctor, thank you for your time. Good to talk
to you. Happy to be with you.
So you've been an advocate for early intervention. In other words, as soon as someone starts getting symptoms, he or she should get on medication right away. Why wasn't this idea picked up by the medical establishment initially?
It costs too little.
Oh, really? That's interesting. So this is the bottom line. It's about money then. It's about profiteering. Interesting.
Yes. The pandemic was well thought out well before it hit our kind of public knowledge frame. And they knew, the powers that be in the pharma world and government regulatory agencies like FDA and CDC and NIH knew that these drugs existed and worked because they had been studied since at least 2005 in the SARS-CoV-1, the first minor, small COVID outbreak, and they were known to be effective. And so when COVID happened this time in a much larger degree, they were already prepared to stifle these medications, to suppress them at all costs. Because you can imagine, if you have a medication that costs for treatment $5, $6 for a full course of treatment, mm-hmm. That are you going to spend $3,000? You know, for an expensive treatment, there's just no way. And, or $1,000 for a vaccination and so on. There's no way that the pharma companies would make any money on a fair playing field. And so they tilted the playing field by suppressing these drugs, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Right, right. And they did that on the basis of fake science, fraudulent science.
But why would the government decide to spend so much money when there were cheaper alternatives that were out there, if indeed they did work? I know Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, all these manufacturers of these all these pharmaceutical companies, their goal is to give a profit to their investors there. But doesn't the government do its due diligence? It seemed like the world got into the Moderna and Pfizer boat.
Well, the problem is that the regulatory agencies have been corrupted by pharma money. FDA takes about 65% of its income from what are called user fees from pharma. FDA treats pharma as its users, not the general public. FDA doesn't represent the interests of the general public. The FDA treats the pharma industry as its clients. And it has been infiltrated to a very large degree in its regulatory capacity by people who are enthralled to pharma. And you have to remember that if you have a government agency with very highly specialized technical people who have to do scientific reviews and analysis of these kinds of data and studies, the only place that they can progress in their careers is either up in a very tight triangle, a pyramid scheme within the FDA, or into pharma.
Yep.
And if they start, you know, being critical of pharma, they don't get a job, and therefore they don't get, you know, they don't move up in their careers. So it's a total conflict of interest the way that drugs and vaccines are reviewed today. Excuse me. And so we're kind of stuck here with a fraudulent, corrupted system that the FDA and CDC have been, what it's called, captured by the pharma industry.
Doctor, let's talk about the vaccines as well. Moderna and Pfizer, they were based on this mRNA technology. Can you explain what that is, why it was so novel? I know there was a lot of excitement about it may be able to be used for, you know, other types of disease treatment as well. Is there a concern? Do you have a concern with mRNA technology and its use in these vaccines?
Well, I think the idea was brilliant, that what you do is you make a complicated molecule that's basically an envelope on the outside and mRNA on the inside, and you make the outside in such a way that it can latch onto human body cells and insert the contents into the inside of the cell. And then so that mRNA is released in the cell, and the cell can't tell the difference between that mRNA and the other mRNA that cells normally work on. And so the cells process the vaccine mRNA, and that mRNA makes the protein product that sits on the outside of the cells. It's called a spike protein, which is the antigen that the virus actually uses to stimulate the immune system. So it was a very clever idea in the first place. The problem is that what wasn't calibrated are two things. First of all, how much spike protein the human body cells make is not calibrated, because some cells can make a lot, some can make a little, some can be busy making other things, some can be quiescent and only make the spike protein. So it's not very well regulated. And the second thing that wasn't actually registered properly is that the spike protein itself is a toxic protein, and the lipoparticles, the outside envelope particles that contain the mRNA inside, are also toxic proteins. And the design of this was inadequate in order to have figured out what needed to be used, that there are other proteins on the surface of the virus that could have been chosen to be the antigens for the immune system to respond to. But they chose the spike protein, which is toxic, and they chose a delivery vehicle, this nanolipoprotein, the envelope, the shell around the mRNA, which is also toxic. And they never controlled for the fact that these particles go all throughout the body. They don't just stay in the shoulder where they're injected. They go all throughout the body, and they can cause damage. And in particular, if they get into the bloodstream, they can stick to the lining of the bloodstream and cause clotting.
Wow.
And that's one of the problems that we've seen that you were remarking about, which is these fatal proteinaceous long stringy clots that are what happens when the blood clots and the clotting mechanism just goes into complete thorough clot, and it makes these structural things. You can think that the purpose of a clot is to prevent the blood from leaking out. And so the clotting system doesn't just plug the hole. It plugs the hole, and then it makes tissue out of the plug to be kind of a permanent patch on the inside of the leaky blood vessel. And so what this is doing is it's filling up the blood vessels with this permanent patch.
Well, fascinating. So those reports about these long-stringing clots coming out of the dead, you believe are authentic, right?
I believe they're likely to be true, yes.
Yeah, and you know, this has a profound impact on women's health, too. We're hearing that, you know, there is concern about fertility issues linked to the vaccine. And I'm curious as to your thought on that. Another report I read said the vaccinated women who got the COVID vaccine, they experienced an increase of less than one day in their menstrual cycle, which could, of course, cause health problems down the line for them. You know, can you speak to this point? Because I am concerned about fertility, what we're going to see in the days ahead for young women who are fertile and want to have children. And has it affected women's menstrual struggles? Have you heard anything about that?
So my understanding is, yes, it has affected women's menstrual cycles, that it makes them more irregular and or lengthens them by a day, 2-3 days. Whether that's of consequence or not is very difficult to know. And the more fundamental problem is, does that have a profound effect on fertility?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's well established yet. Naomi Wolf has been working on that with her crew of people looking at the Pfizer documents. There's some evidence that menstrual irregularities are a common adverse effect in reproductive age women, but we still don't know the adequacy of the science that's come out about that is uncertain, and so we just don't know yet how bad or not that'll be.
Okay, well, doctor, I'll tell you what, let's grab a call or two if you want to join us. I only have the doctor for a few minutes. We're approaching the end of the show soon. We're taking a look at whether or not we are now post-COVID and what evidence or, you know, what's now surfacing from those who have been vaccinated. And, doctor, I'd love to talk to you about detox for those who've had it. If there's ways to safeguard one's health as well, we can get into that as well. But let's jump into the phones. The number 888-914-9149. We'll go to Delaware County, Pennsylvania. I know that area well. Bernadette, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for listening to me. I work in Delaware County at a nursing home facility. We have independent residents, people that live, you know, independently, and those that are sick. So we had a big vaccine day, and we probably gave out about roughly 200 COVID vaccines. I was stunned at the number of residents that maybe could have gone to a CVS or a Rite Aid, gotten the vaccine in July, and the pharmacist was willing to give them another one so long as it was over 60 days. So if they got a vaccine in July, they were getting it again the beginning of October.
Mm. All right. Doctor, your thoughts on Bernadette?
It's not even a year.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Bernadette. Let me let Dr. Risch respond to you.
Well, the vaccination now for a potential wave that might come in December or January is almost useless. And the CDC has basically said this, that they said on August 11th that two shots do not control transmission of the virus, and getting boosters only provides a transient benefit which wanes. The evidence that I've seen so far about that transient benefit is by the third or fourth booster, the benefit only lasts about 6 to 8 weeks. And if you take a vaccine now, 6 to 8 weeks from now, you're going to have lost most of that benefit. And we know that if this falls into a seasonal pattern, like the last winter when we had a big wave, if there's a wave this winter, it's likely to occur in December, January, February. Okay. And so it's too soon to take anything now. The second problem is that the booster that's available now, it's for a strain that's going away. It's for the calibrated for the BA5 strain.
Yeah, yeah.
What's increasing now is BA4.6, which is going to be at least half of the infections by December, if not more. And so whether this vaccine even works in the first place for that is uncertain.
Yeah, my guest today, Dr. Harvey Risch, you know, Doctor, you bring up a really good point there, something for people to think about. This time last year, the Omicron variant had really yet to appear. It didn't come on the radar until, I think it was late November, and then it fundamentally changed everything. And I'm just curious as to what we might be seeing. I heard there may be another variant out there. I think they've been trying to track this. I don't have the number in front of me. I was reading it a little bit earlier, but it's supposed to be very evasive. So the vaccines that most people already have, it would render them relatively ineffectual. So I have to take a break coming up in a second, but just a quick thought from you, if I could. Are we out of COVID? Is it in our rearview mirror, or are we going to continue to battle this for a long time?
We're out of bad COVID. We're in easy COVID, I'd put it that way.
Easy COVID. All right, well, stay with me. When we come back, our lines are full here. A lot of people want to talk to you. Feel free to join us. 888-914-9149. Speaking with Dr. Harvey Risch, we're taking a look at the COVID vaccines. You might have taken one of a number of them that are out there. And what we're now beginning to discover, some of the side effects of those. We're also just taking a look at COVID. What looms in the future? And how do you best safeguard yourself from this as well? We're back with more right after this. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Connect with Drew on the Relevant Radio app.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Live, coast to coast. A look at life you'll never get anywhere else. The Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Taking a look at COVID-19. I know a lot of people think, hey, it's behind us, right? Been vaccinated. How safe are you? One of the biggest questions is how these vaccines impact your health, clotting. How about infertility? How about the unborn child? The government health agencies who are promoting it say, hey, they're safe. They're perfectly safe. That's why a lot of people have gotten their vaccines. Dr. Aaron Cariotti, who's a regular friend of this show, he hails from the University of California, Irvine, a great physician and psychiatrist, was on Twitter, and he posted something. He says there was a study in JAMA Pediatrics that lactating women are expressing mRNA in their milk. And the question is, are they really safe for pregnant in lactating women? How long does it persist in our body? Is there a way to detox from this? You know, what do we know? Does it accelerate or exacerbate cancer? My guest today, Dr. Harvey Risch, it's good to have him with us. He's a professor emeritus of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine. Doctor, so much to get into. I want to jump into the phones. Before I do, though, I shared a story about this one doctor who really believes that he got his booster shot. He was double. He had his vaccinations, one and two, and then got boosted. Then he saw an acceleration in his cancer. Do you know anything? Is there any link to this vaccine and cancer?
My understanding is that the vaccines do not cause cancer, but they affect the immune system, which acts as a regulatory apparatus that sees cancer as a foreign tissue and tries to control it and get rid of it like it sees bacteria and tries to get rid of bacteria. And it's a battle between the immune system and the cancer. Most of the time, when cancers start, the immune system is able to recognize it and get rid of the offending cells, and so the cancer doesn't get a foothold. Sometimes, however, the cancer grows fast enough and the immune system doesn't respond well enough, and that's when cancers occur, and then they grow at a certain rate, and that rate is determined again by how much the immune system can suppress it versus how well the cancer can grow. Now, if you affect the immune system by the vaccine that damages the immune system's ability to combat the cancer, then the cancer will grow faster and can come to diagnosis sooner. That's my understanding of a possible role.
All right. Sounds great. We'll take a few calls. By the way, I was trying to come up with that new variant that was out there. Some Swedish researchers announced in a preprint, not a yet peered review, but they identified what they claim is another viral variant dubbed BA.2.75.2. And they say it exhibits more extreme antibody escape than any other variant they've seen so far, meaning that the existing vaccines, possibly including the brand new Omicron bivalence, might not successfully suppress it. So we'll see what the future holds for us. Ann's listening in Chicago. Ann, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Dr. Risch.
Well,
Sorry, Doc.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. I have been affected by the Pfizer vaccine. I still feel it in my arm at times on a regular basis. Also, when I eat something, my mouth goes bone dry. And I've lost a lot of weight for it, which is good, but I know it's part of my autoimmune system. Well, my question is, how do I detox from the vaccine?
Great question. I still have effects.
Yeah.
It's a great question, Ann. Let me hold you on that point so the doctor can talk about it. A lot of people listening saying, gosh, is there a way to detox? I don't have any symptoms. Other people may have a lot of these symptoms. What would you suggest? Is it even possible to detox from this? And how long does that mRNA stay in your system?
So the answer about detox is we're at uncharted territory. Okay. That medicine has never dealt with this in the past. And many doctors, if not most, are reticent to get involved because it's tantamount to admission that the vaccines have been damaging. One sees this also to a certain degree with what's called long COVID and people who've had adverse reactions to the virus itself and were not treated aggressively when they first got sick. And there's an overlap in these kinds of symptoms. There are telemedicine groups that are working on this, and if one goes to the earlycovidcare.org website, there's a list of a number of telemedicine groups that are trying to get a handle and understand and treat both long COVID and vaccine adverse effects. So that's earlycovidcare.org. It's hard to be optimistic at this point, but my understanding is that the offending spike protein can stay in the body in some people up to 6 months.
That's not bad.
Most people, it doesn't stay that long. Most people, it should be gone in 6 to 8 weeks. And it's hard to be patient for that length of time when you've got debilitating symptoms, I know. But I would still remain optimistic. And there are medications that can be used to try to modulate that a bit that these telemedicine groups have been using.
So anybody who's been vaccinated, they can rest assured that the deleterious effects, perhaps, of the vaccine, if it was to take a place, only lasts about 6 months. Then you're back to how you were pre-vaccine?
That doesn't work for everybody. There are some people who have been permanently damaged, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that over time, there is the ability to some degree to try to recover some of the normal functioning. It's hard to know and really requires clinicians who have been studying this and working on treating patients.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll take another call. Patricia is listening in Reno, Nevada. She's been double vaxxed and double boosted. Hi, Patricia. You're on the air with Dr. Harvey Risch.
Oh, yes. I don't know if you already answered this. I'm so sorry. But I just wondered, being doubly vaccinated and boosted, would you recommend my getting the new vaccine that will be coming out, and also for my elderly parents, yeah, too, one who is does not have any health problems, but she's 85.
Good question.
Well, age in and of itself is not a major risk factor for doing poorly with COVID. What matters much more so are the common chronic conditions that correlate very highly with age, like cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, cancer, immune diseases, things like that. Obesity and diabetes is another one. And so if somebody doesn't have any of those, they are very likely to be able to do well with this infection, especially if they have adequate vitamin D intake. Everybody should be taking vitamin D. Across the whole country, everybody has some degree of vitamin D deficiency and needs supplementation with vitamin D, and it's harmless at the doses, and it's inexpensive at the doses that people should be taking. So that's one thing that everybody should do. Now, as to the new booster, my recommendation is to wait. That there's arguments pro and con for it, depending on each person's personal medical condition, and this is something that should be discussed with a sensitive, responsive physician who can weigh both sides of the risks and benefits. That being said, there's no point in doing it now. that we need to see what's going to happen by more or less the end of November. That if we get stuck in another wave, if this BA 4.6 or the BA 2.75.2, if either of those really comes up in large numbers, not just in proportion, but in large numbers of cases, and people are really getting sick from those, then people should decide at the end of November whether they think they would want to take a booster that may or may not be effective at that point. There's no point in taking it now because hardly anything is happening now that can't be managed with outpatient treatment. And the main thing that you have to realize is that the Omicron variants, even as they've evolved, are still relatively mild in the scale of things. I'm recovering now myself from a COVID infection, which is why I sound a little breathy and have some cough left from a week and a half of dealing with it. And it was unpleasant for me to have had it, but I treated it with hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, antibiotics, and it did not last very long, and it's gone away. And there's very good evidence for doing that in general for many people who need it, who would otherwise be at higher risk of adverse events. But again, Omicron is not such a serious infection compared to the original.
Dr. Emmer, thank you for your time. It's great to talk with you. I'd love to have you back. Our lines are stacked. A lot of people want to get in. But I'm up against the clock, and I've got to leave it right there. My thanks to Dr. Harvey Risch, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine.